So basically, if we want to now look at applying these principles, this means we should study very nicely what Krishna is advising in the Bhagavad Gita, that of being able to do work in the proper mood. It's basically that is the essential point. It's not so much what you're doing, but in what is the mood in which you're doing it. Of course, there are certain prescribed activities that Krishna has chosen, that this is the best sphere of activities to do that. So if one can do proper activities in the proper mood, then this is pleasing to Krishna. So this idea to understand is very important. When we're young or when we don't know so much, then of course we do what others are doing. That is natural. You see, the children, they just follow what the adults do. But then when they start to think for themselves, then one can either follow that good example now by studying and understanding it, or one can speculate and make one's own idea. This is an essential point. We have this choice. We can either follow that which we've been taught and shown, or we can make up our own. These are what we have. So the living entity must be very careful to understand that the freedom of choice, the intellectual freedoms to understand and to be able to apply these things in our life, this is very much what the Lord desires. Right? The Lord wants us to be intelligent. But in how we use the intelligence, that is also very important. How we use that intelligence, that is of great importance. Because we can use this intelligence to do our own kind of activity, our own thing, make up our own process. Or we use our intelligence to see and understand what the Supreme Lord has given us, what the Acharyas have given us, and then use our intelligence to do it in a very, very wonderful way. Just like we see, Lord Chaitanya wants that preaching spread all over the world. And then we see that the Acharyas then take this instruction, and in very amazing and special ways, they apply it. And many times very diverse. Narottam Das Thakur is known for his songs. You know, Bhakti Vinod Thakur for his particular work of reestablishing the credence of the Vaishnava tradition. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur for establishing the preaching machinery of the Gaudiya mission. And then Srila Prabhupada of taking so many of these teachings and spreading them all over the world. And in a very special way, in which the mood and the flavor of the Vedic culture is kept intact, though it is implanted in a different culture, where different values, different everything. Srila Prabhupada's, I think one of his, speaking with one of the God brothers who had gone to the West, and they were talking about when you go there, you'll have to learn how to dress in suit and tie, and eat with a fork and knife, and all these different things. And Prabhupada's mood was, no, I go there to teach them how to wear, you know, dhotis and saris and how to eat with their fingers. So this was a very, very special contribution. So this is intelligence. And you see the unique identity of each person is very nicely manifest. So it's just a matter of what is the sphere. In any situation, you see that there is always restriction. That's always there. It doesn't matter. Even the materialists who are very proud of their independence and free thinking, still they have certain realms in which they can work. Like if you want to be accepted in the academic world as a free thinker, still you have to use the academic language. You have to go to the academic conferences. You have to write your papers the way other academics will accept them. It must be done in that way. So there is a basic restriction, and then you're called an academic. And if you don't follow that, you're not called an academic. But you may be very unique in that field for your thoughts and abilities of application and that. Or in architecture, then you have to work with your line drawings and these things and make your blueprints, and you have to, you know, have your little box in the corner that gives details, and you know, you have to put the buildings up, they can't be upside down. And so many things, you're restricted. But within that, you can be very unique. So the whole communications, the whole interactions between living entities is based on this principle of restricting yourself within a field of activities. And then within that field of activities, then you can function very nicely. We're already restricted by our specific senses that we have. Our eyes can only see so much, our ears can only see so much, nose smells so much. And the mind, the intelligence, it has its sphere it can deal in. So by nature, we're already restricted. So the whole idea in the Vedic culture is now figure out how to best use these restrictions that you have in the field that you have to serve Krishna. Right? We go beyond this field, you know, like dogs can hear things we can't see or see things we can't see, and you know, there's animals that can see in the night, but not, and all these, so many things. They can do things beyond us, but it's meant for the animals. Because in the spiritual realm, then Krishna is inviting us to take part in his world. And in his world, you know, he just likes to see these particular colors. He's not interested in everything will be, you know, ultraviolet or all kinds of strange things or sounds that no one can hear. Like that. Within this sphere, then everything is done very nicely. He finds that this is the best atmosphere. The human area of understanding, or how do you say, not understanding so much as the field of activities of the human. We see that in Vrindavan, that so many interesting things happen, but Krishna still takes care of them in a human way. It's like Indra comes and he sends so much rain, thunder, and so many disturbances. Now, Krishna is the Supreme Lord. All he has to do is will, and it'll all go away. And it will, you know, and then it'll be very mystic, or he'll show his prowess, his potency. But instead, just like a human being, when it starts to rain, you use an umbrella. You know, you don't use your mystic powers to get rid of the rain. You just make some adjustment within the rain, within your power. So Krishna lifts an umbrella. But he does it in such a way that it serves his purpose. And Indra is humbled. And all the residents of Vrindavan are protected. Of course, they are thinking that different people are thinking different things because of Nanda Baba and that, because they were also putting their sticks on there. They were all holding it up. And others were thinking it's because of the affection of Mother Yashoda for Krishna. Therefore, the mountain was held up. So many different reasons that they were all thinking. The cowherd boys were thinking, ah, it wasn't Krishna. We were doing it, actually. You know, he's just a, you know, kid, you know. So, like this, everybody had their different visions. But it would still be within that human realm. So this is a very, very tasty or sweet realm in which to work. A field of activities to work in. So Krishna has chosen those activities then within that field that he considers the best. He divides the whole field up into the mode of goodness, mode of passion, and mode of ignorance. And you can get various results by working in those ways within the field. But he recommends that you work within the mode of goodness, because the mode of goodness is elevating. That is a very important principle, that the mode of goodness, by doing that, you're elevated. It's not, we will always think we have to be very careful that many things are happening at once. If it was so simple and straightforward, we would have worked it out a long time ago. But because it's very complex, we find difficulty in understanding. Because here we're recommending, Krishna is recommending everyone to do work in the mode of goodness. But that doesn't mean that the particular activity that you're doing, that the activity itself may be controlled by different modes. But the way in which we do that activity is controlled by the mood of goodness. It is done in the mode of goodness. So this is what is very special about our philosophy, is the ability to see two contradictory things balanced. Achinta beda beda tattva. Simultaneously one and different. So that is what is unique in our philosophy. You don't find this in the other Vaishnava philosophies. It's just very direct, much more easily understood. You know, one doesn't have to be so fine in the perception. It's either one, or it's two, or it's one and two, not simultaneously. You know, or it's kind of one, a very pure form of one, like that. You know, a special way of describing one. So these are the different ways that it's there, but you don't have it's one and it's two both at the same time. So this, with this understanding, we have to be able to see that there's many things happening at once. You have a body that works according to, it's best situated in particular acts, particular activities. Those activities may be controlled by different modes. But you are going to do those modes in the mode of goodness. I mean, you're going to do those activities in the mode of goodness. And not only that, we're going to try to that's not even good enough, we're going to try to bring that to pure goodness by proper desire, not being attached to the results. You know, not ego that I'm doing it. So this is what we're trying to get. And then that gets the devotee. That's why the devotee is so unique. And it is not easy to understand. So so one performs the duties that go along with the body, where one's comfortably situated, one performs those activities under the guidance of authority. But at the same time, we have to do those for Krishna. So this is very, very important, that there's our devotional life, our devotional consciousness, and then the particular activity that we perform for Krishna. So when one can see all these at once, our desire to surrender, in other words, three things are happening at once. See, if we can just surrender to Krishna, only one thing's happening at once. If that is not there, then that has to be there, that desire, plus the sadhana has to be there, the life of sadhana. And if that, it will not fully take care of all your activities, then you add a third of working then for Krishna. So we're dealing with pure spiritual nature, or the conditional nature, but fully in contact, directly in contact with the spiritual nature. Or we're dealing with our conditional nature, working within the sphere of our conditional nature, but surcharged with this Krishna consciousness. So we have to be able to balance all those three at once. So this is what Krishna is recommending, that you do that work according to your nature, but do it for Him. Right? So that becomes part of your sadhana. Right? And our sadhana is for surrender to Krishna. So when we talk about our sadhana, that includes our service. Right? Part in the Pancharatra is that you are doing all these activities, the culture that is there, but you also have particular service you're going to do for the deity. The whole point of Pancharatra is you're going to work for the deity. So you're either working directly as a pujari, or you're taking care of his grounds, or you're taking care of the devotees, you're raising funds, whatever you're doing, but it's being done for the deities. And if you have a house, then you think that this is also Krishna's house, and we're taking care of that for Krishna. And then in that mood, one can perform the activities nicely. Then it becomes very, very, very practically engaged. So these are important considerations in which when we apply our activity. So we should study. Where we started was, is that now that we've come to consciousness, then we should study. We should try to understand and deepen our realization on this matter. Chaitanya Charitamrita then recommends this, is by working in devotion, then one gets realization. That is, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami points that out, is the how one gets realization. One can get knowledge by studying, But one gets realization by working in devotion. You take that knowledge you've heard and you perform devotional activities with the purpose of trying to please Krishna, then you get realization. So it's a very practical thing. It's tangible. That it's a very direct process. You serve Krishna with realization. I mean, with understanding, you get realization. It means if you just work, of course, the heart becomes purified, and then we have realization. But it's still based on we've heard. But if we're able to study more and serve more, the realization is also very, very great. Any questions on this point? Yes, sir.
Maybe I missed at the beginning, but it was also from yesterday. How do you think, I'm wondering how you see that the Vedic culture gets influenced by local culture. Like when I was traveling in America, we have one temple where there's a lot of, say, there's a lot of devotees from Africa, so the kirtan definitely had an African flavor. Or in other countries, the food, you know, Italy, you have dominantly, you know, pastas and pizzas. So is that all right, or how do you...
There's two aspects of this. Is the main principle is still whatever is whatever we're supposed to do. Like one should always hear and chant about Krishna. One should always offer one's foodstuffs to Krishna and take the remnants. You know, one should do one's activities for Krishna. So that's the main central principle. So as long as that is being fulfilled, then advancement is there. So even though one may dance, you know, in a traditional tribal African way, or one may cook, you know, more the local cuisines, then as long as it's done in that mood, then advancement is there. So it's not bad. But generally one would find that would be more of a situation you would find with those living outside the temple. Because outside the temple, then you basically have to move more with your own conditioned nature, with the surroundings that are with you. And then it's very much up to the individual on where they are able to situate themselves. But at least they start from taking whatever they know and do, purify it, and offer it to Krishna. So while the temple is ideally will set a more clear example like that. That is always good. This is explained by Satyabhama and Gauranga Lila. Yeah, Jagadananda Pandit explains this point. Is that in the beginning, we do our activities for Krishna, but we don't necessarily choose something that has definitely come from, that's directed by Krishna. We choose something that we like to do. Like in the beginning, we like to eat certain things, so we offer those to Krishna. Because the principle is you offer the best. So in our mind, you know, maybe pizza and pasta are the best, or you know, Africa, then varieties of beans are the best, or, you know, whatever it may be. But we offer the best to Krishna, what we think is the best. So that's a principle. Sanatana Goswami mentions that, one can offer the best of the local cuisine and these things to the deities, because that's what everybody values. So when that's there, then everyone's excited and thinks, yes, this is very high worship. You know? But that stage is called Aropya Bhakti. Means where you superimpose your ideas on the devotional process. Is that I like pasta, I think it's the best, I should offer the best to Krishna, I offer that to Krishna. So Krishna accepts that, because that is we're making that endeavor to do something nice for Krishna. But then with time, as one becomes purified, then one comes to the point to understand, well, Krishna is also a person. So now I'm serving him. So now maybe it would be better to find out what he likes to eat and offer that to him, rather than just offer him what I like to eat. Then that comes to the next stage. Then you start taking up more the traditional line, because the traditional line means how Krishna likes it. So basically what we're saying many times when we say, well, it's not practical or don't be fanatic, means we would rather offer what we want to Krishna than what Krishna is specifically, accustomed to, like that. Krishna, of course, is eating the devotion. So whether you cook rice, dal, and sabji, you cook pasta, it's the devotion that it's offered. So ultimately, on that plane, it doesn't matter. But as far as the culture goes, Krishna prefers to see that devotion offered to him through this particular kinds of medium. Particular medium, dress, ways of doing things, ways of singing or dancing, or all these different activities. Because that is he has picked the best culture. And whatever is the best, topmost, most wonderful culture, he has chosen that for Vrindavan. So you see that Vrindavan, or his Gauranga Lila. So these manifestations are what he thinks are the best. So the point is offering that love to Krishna. But also is you have to offer that love through something. Some medium must be there. So Krishna has picked the best mediums that he considers the best. And we're given that opportunity. It's actually amazing what we're being given. See, is generally you'll find all the other acharyas. In other words, in one day of Brahma, you have 1,000 divya yugas. So that means 4,000 yugas are happening every day of Brahma. 4,000, and each one has their avatar. Specific avatar. So that means 4,000 avatars. Out of that, they're all opening the doors to Vaikuntha. But now, out of 4,000, two avatars open the door to Vrindavan. And that's it. Two out of 4,000. So that's very, very special. That's when Swayam Krishna comes, and when Swayam Krishna comes as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the fortune that is there to have come at the time where that 2 out of 4,000 is happening is very unique. And what's being offered that's different is being offered this Vrindavan culture. All the other times the Vaikuntha culture is being offered. This the Vrindavan culture is being offered. And what they do there, the acharyas are giving us. It's so nice. It's just like we're beggars off the street, but we're being brought into the palace and we're being offered the culture and all that of the royalty that is going on. But somehow or another, we're very attached to our street culture, our street language. You know, we like taking our spray cans and our style of writing on the walls and, the way we dress and all these different things. But we're being offered this other, like a simple thing. I was just saw the other day, someone was reading. And when Radharani cooks for Krishna, then what she cooks, all these special kind of sweets, are put on a big plate, a big gold plate. And then it's covered with a very fine silk cloth. And then one of her assistants carries that to Nanda Maharaj's house, and then it's served to Krishna. So you cook in one place and it's taken to the other. So we have that. We've been given that we cook, and then afterwards we make the plate, and then we cover it with a fine cloth and take it to the deities. But many, many times you see devotees think, well, this is not so practical. Why do we have to cover it? Or we'll use all kinds of strange things to cover it. But it's the culture is there. What they do in Vrindavan is being offered to us. We can do it right here. We make the plate nicely, cover it with a fine cloth, and take it to Krishna. And then when we put it on the altar, then we take the cloth off. But it's not understood what we're being given. We're being given the topmost thing that, Radharani and her personal assistants, they are doing these things. But we have our own idea, our own attachments. So then we impose upon the pure spiritual culture our own method of application, which as long as we're doing it for Krishna, Krishna accepts it. Right? Just like a small child may do things in its own way, but it's accepted. But when that child grows and then is attached to their own thing, then it's considered a disturbance. So if the devotees are very enthusiastic, they may, you know, have a particular background, they perform in a particular way, and they're very ecstatic and thinking of Krishna and chanting, and in this way, Krishna accepts it. But if they actually think this is a better way of dancing, then there's a problem. Right? It means if one thinks, I only know how to cook this pasta, I'm cooking this pasta, I'm offering to Krishna, you know, what can we do? Then that's okay. But if we actually think pasta is a superior foodstuff than rice, dal, and sabji and all these other things, then there's a problem. Because then we're accepting a lower culture and we're attached to it. That means whatever we're doing, we're attached. So the Aropya Bhakti then drops even from there. It's just Aropya, it's not even Bhakti. Because then instead of Krishna is choosing the different things, and I fully don't understand that. I'm not mature enough to understand that Krishna is the one who chose rice, dal, and sabji. Right? But I just understand the principle behind it, that it's not the rice, dal, and sabji that's important, but it's the devotion which it's offered. I take that and I offer what I want to offer. But after a while I understand that not only is the principle important, but Krishna has picked these ways of application. So then, in other words, Krishna, with our understanding, we're expanding by Krishna. It's not just knowledge. Does that make some sense? In other words, you've gone from the principle, and you're doing whatever detail, and you're getting the principle. But then there's also details that Krishna has chosen, and if I can do them, fine. If I can't get rice, or I can't get these things, okay, we cook whatever we can get our hands on. You know? But if we can get, and it's not an over-endeavor, and it's not, you know, beyond our, you know, abilities or expenses, then we try for that. We know that's the better principle. Like that. We'll settle for what's practical, but we know what the standard is. This also reflects in this what we discussed yesterday. Is we know, everyone knows that one has to become detached from everything. Akinchana gochara. One has to be completely detached from the material world. And then one can go back to Godhead. It means at the time of death you have to be not attached to anything here. As Prabhupada said, if you're attached to one gulab jamun, you have to come back and take birth so that you can get plenty of gulab jamuns, like that. So we all understand that. So one can only get to that platform if you respect that platform. That's essential. Is that you can get to a platform of that you respect. Like if you respect someone who is very intelligent, you know, or very well read, or good in their sadhana, you respect that activity, respect the person who's doing that activity. You can get to that activity. But if you don't respect that activity or don't respect the person who's doing it, one can't get there. So one must respect that that is the proper standard. Maybe I don't have the facilities. You know, I read about all these nice things and bitter melon and spinach and all these things being offered to Krishna. You know, but I'm out in the middle of the, you know, Central Asia and the only thing available is potatoes. So, you know, I do the best I can. But you respect that higher form, you know. Maybe in the beginning we don't understand it's there, like that. That's not a problem. But once we start to understand, as we start to mature and all that, then we can't remain attached to our what we're kind of like laying on top of the devotional. It means our interests and all that we're kind of putting over, like an overlay over the devotional process. In the beginning that's all right, but when we start to discriminate, then we have to discriminate. Then we're discriminating between what Krishna has chosen or what we choose. So then it's always advisable to take what Krishna chooses. And if one can do it, then, you know, as Maharaj was pointing out, best if someone comes, you sit them down, give them something, you know, some water, maybe a little sweet, some nice words, and comfort them, and, you know, wash their feet, so many things. If you can't do that, then, you know, something less, and at least a mat on the floor. If you can't do that, then at least you stand there and say, you know, welcome. If you can't do that, then you better roll on the ground and start crying, you know, like that. So there's always, the Vedas are very, very practical. That's the thing. If we study them, we'll see they're the most practical. That means this point of reception can be there from the king, how he will receive somebody, down to the poorest person. You know, even to the person who's living under a tree and has nothing. I mean, they can all receive somebody and follow the principle. So the Vedic culture is very broad because Krishna is very practical. He made the place, so he's quite expert, you know. And so therefore, we can follow all these different directions that Krishna has given and be happy. But we must always maintain, of course, the principle that's behind those different choices of Krishna. So, yes, Maharaj.
We're talking about superimposition by, for example, European culture. But now sometimes we see that, for example, South Indian cultural practices or forms of worship have become institutionalized in various ISKCON temples outside of South India, outside India or even in Mayapur. How are we to do that?
Basically, is when we come to, it depends upon whether we're talking about a cultural practice or a particular ritual, you know, because the cultural practice is how the local people will apply the particular rule, and the ritual then is strict Shastric rituals that one chooses from. So it's recommended that amongst the rituals, then you take, you know, what the acharyas give us, and they give explicit areas from which to take it, and then one has to be, expert enough or, you know, wise enough to apply them to your circumstance, how they fit, then it's all right. And you'll see in some of them it doesn't matter. Just like Rupa Goswami says, when you install a pot, the kumbha, with the coconut and everything, he doesn't say how to do it, because everyone's coming from different backgrounds, different Vedas, they use different pancharatras or different tantras. Point is the pot should be installed. Now what you do with it, after you install it, then he tells you. Because then that is important for the Vaishnava line. How you'll worship, what is your mood towards the deity in the pot. But how you technically get the deity into the pot, he doesn't care. So you will find even within the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, as given by Sanatan Goswami, Gopal Bhatta Goswami, and Rupa Goswami, then there is some scope for a little variation. But the main principles will always be the same, you know, because it's more the mood in which you do the ritual that's important than the ritual itself. So what one has to be careful of is we may take a ritual that is, you know, he gives something, he just says install the pot. So if we take a South Indian ritual or a North Indian ritual or, you know, this, that doesn't matter. But now the emphasis on how much emphasis we give to that pot and how much that draws everyone's attention in the worship, that then we have to take the mood of the acharyas. That we shouldn't introduce a South Indian mood or a North Indian or, you know, Bengal or this or that. That we should induce the mood. I think we were discussing yesterday something, is that this principle of yukta vairagya means that you may use something in Krishna's service, but you use it according to our culture and our balance. Just like this microphone. This is, you know, material thing. It's a modern thing. We use them. But we don't use it with the culture that you'll find necessarily that those who are, you know, used to these things use it. Like that. For us, it's just something that makes some sound and increases the sound. Like, remember in Mayapur, then it was a very big temple and there was never any microphones or anything because generally there was never any electricity. So you didn't bother with such, you know, trivial things like microphones. So at one point somehow someone got very enthusiastic and hung a mic from the ceiling. They made this whole contraption where they had this mechanical sliding thing and the microphone could come down to the level where you sing, so there's nothing on the ground. So no wires and all this, and they thought it was very nice. So then the first morning Mangal Arti was used, then one of the devotees came up and started using the microphone. But they were using it more in a Western style. You get very, very close and sorry, everything's right here. And Prabhupada from upstairs then sent someone down and said that this sound is demoniac. They were singing Mangal Arti, singing Hare Krishna, but he said the sound was demoniac. Because the person was not using it within our culture. They were using it within the Western cultural context. So the whole point was lots of now sound, a little distortion. You know, it's like over, you know, totally, overbearing, overpowering. And, you know, everybody thought it was normal because that's the way when you were a kid you listened to music. You know, you turn it up so that, you know, halfway down the block people can hear it. And then you feel satisfied, you know what they're saying. But Prabhupada just said this is demoniac. You know? So you have to use the thing. It means the Yukta Vairagya means using it how we use it. Like you have a car. You may have a nice car. But now we will drive it how we would drive it. As a gentleman, it's Krishna's car. We have to be careful. We drive nicely. We don't get into it because the speedometer says 240 that we do that. You know? Because that's what someone else would do. Right? You're in Germany, you have a big car, the speedometer says 240, then at least you should be doing 200, 190, you know, or whatever you can, because that's what it's for. That's what the car is. It was built for. But we'll use it just, we want to get from this temple to that temple. But we don't follow that culture, you know, the car culture. We follow our own culture, we use the car. So in the same way, we can use everything in Krishna's service, but we must bring it into the context of our own culture. So that is what's very important. Otherwise, if we don't do that, then I see nowadays the Yukta Vairagya, I mean, before was a very general term, use anything in Krishna's service with this principle. But now the modern term is use anything modern in Krishna's service and nothing Vedic. Vedic cannot be, Vedic is, you know, that's off, that's bogus. You can't engage anything Vedic in Krishna's service. You can only engage Western things in Krishna's service. I see it's very, very common, you know, like that. And if you suggest it, then you're fanatic, you know. It's not, you know. So then one must understand is it doesn't matter if it's Vedic or what's going on in India now that's coming down from the Vedic tradition or in the West. You can take it, use it in Krishna's service as long as you remove that local mood that goes with it. Like that. It means that covering of, because someone is doing that in that particular way because of a covering of a particular consciousness or a particular activity, means their mentality. You have to remove that and insert our mentality, our consciousness. And then if it's useful, either it's recommended in the scriptures, and it's just like now, what do we have? We have the razor's edge, right? How many people are on the razor's edge? Right? Not so many. So that means all of the culture that is there that we want to reclaim is either with the Mayavadis or with the Sahajis. You know? That's all. Or with the Smartas and with just the sentimental people. So you have to go out and get it back. Right? Just like we want to learn Mridanga. Right? How many of our Gaudiya Vaishnavs, you know, who are full Sampradayic practicing and that know nicely Mridanga? So we may have to go outside and catch one of these people from these various Sahajir, Nityananda Vamsar, this line, because they know the Mridanga well. We take that, but we don't take their mood. You know, we don't play our drum and shake our head the way they shake their head and, you know, grease their hair back and all these different things. We leave all that. We just take the style how they use it. They know that you hit it like this and this beat is used for this kind of tune, and that beat is used for another tune. We take that and we leave the rest of it. You know, the impersonalists may have, you know, systems of how we perform the worship. We take those things but leave their mood in which they worship. You know? Like all these different things. There, you know, many of them are arts or techniques of application. They know it. Shastra says it. We know it has to be done, but we don't know the technique. We get it from wherever. But we can't take their mood. That is very important. You see, anyone who's taken the mood, then they disappear. They go out with them. You go to learn Sanskrit. You take that mood of the Sanskrit professor. Then you become one of them. You know, you go out to learn the academics. You take the mood of those academics. You become one of them. You know, whatever it is, you take the music. And if you don't do it in the right way, if you take more than the music, their mood, you become one of them. You learn Ayurveda, but you take on their mood, you become like that. Point is those are all originally Krishna's subjects, Krishna's arts, Krishna's techniques. But now they're all in the hands of everybody else. Before it was, the majority was devotees. So the sciences were there. But then as people become less and less devotees, the sciences are still there, but now they're in the hands of those who are not. So we have to be able to get them back. This is the principle of the swan. Is you take the milk, leave the water. Like that. So you go in, take what you need, and come out. And that's it. Just because someone is expert in one thing doesn't mean he's expert in everything. Like you go to somebody, and he's expert in techniques of worship. So we may ask him specific things. But we don't now because he's so expert, and then naturally we think, you know, the Western, not so the Western, especially American, if you're good, you're good everything. And if you're bad at everything. You know, it's all or nothing. There's nothing in between. So he knows this. Now I start asking him about other things, how we do our things and all this, and then they give their points, oh, this is wrong, or that's this, or that's that. And then we become bewildered, and then we become one of them. So we very much have to be very careful that we just take what we need, and that's it. Not one thing more. Like that. They're expert in their field, but the real expertise is knowing how to use that in Krishna's service. Right? Otherwise, we know so much we can't use it for Krishna. It doesn't really have any meaning. So the as a beginning stage, that's all right. But ideally, if one wants to, you know, dance with Lord Chaitanya in that, he dances in a certain way. And, you know, then, of course, in ecstasy, then these ways may manifest in so many functions. I was just reading on the bulletin board up there. There's some discussions going back and forth on the, you know, the all-glorious email. And so then the point has come up that Prabhupada didn't appreciate wild, crazy dancing. And then someone wants to know, well, where's that from? And then someone gives some discussions that are there, or was pointing out that the devotees have changed the dancing style from what Prabhupada showed them, you know, the Swami step and all these kind of things. And then when they're discussing with Prabhupada, they're pointing out, you know, how the symptoms of this new style of dance. And he's not really approving certain parts, this and that. At the same time, as it's very much pointed out in this discussion, that Prabhupada didn't want to discourage them. Because at least they were enthusiastic to dance for Krishna, even though they may have kind of had their own ways of doing it and it may not necessarily have been purely done for the deities. But at least they were dancing for Krishna. They weren't in some disco somewhere. So Prabhupada's appreciating that. So it's like he's trying to say is that, okay, you can engage whatever's your you know, wild nature. But better than that is to come to a standard that is our tradition. Like that. So the idea is the temple should be more of a place of the culture and all that. So the temple itself and those devotees in that. And then those who are not fully able to take advantage of that, then they can follow that and it's fine. You know? And so just like Brahmananda, when he went he was preaching in Africa. So when they would go down and do kirtan, then the African tribesmen, they would come and dance in their own style. But they were chanting Hare Krishna and this and that, and Prabhupada was appreciating very much. But when you come into the temple, then those in the temple should show what is our old tradition. And then it's up to the individual to dance how they like. But those who are like representing the culture should show the old culture, you know, as close as they can in that. And everybody else should just pick up on how they can take part and engage themselves. And then that's fine. Does that make any sense? Some comment on that, Swami?
Yes. You say you were speaking about the temple, like Sadhana temple, that there, and there's one one Varna and four Ashrams. But on the other hand, we see that right now, at least in some countries, in temple serves as, I would say, a resocialization institution. Like, we take people from Lecha culture and invite them to join the temple, and it's really difficult for them to take that up, at least in the beginning. and they are asked to represent, but they don't know how to do it. So does it mean that the temple should serve rather as a school? Or
yeah, Baba expected that the society was an educational institution. He always talks about the society is for training people. Specifically, the first thing, this is as Maharaj pointed out yesterday, first thing is train Brahmins. Once you have the head, you have everything else. The head knows how to train Kshatriyas or leaders, and then they'll get it done. That's the whole point. So the first point is train the leaders. So in it's not that within the temple, people don't have their nature and don't do it according to their nature. It means those who have managerial abilities may do that. Those who have other abilities do those. But the point is it's more on the aspect of sadhana. And it's very, very closely engaged. Because, yeah. But the same thing is then you take that and then you must address your nature more. It's like you can only do this kind of thing. Like the manager can manage at the same time he can wash the pots, at the same time he can go out and... Like in early days, I remember it was in, I think, a Colorado temple. The president there and his wife at night used to go down to the Boulder. Boulder? Is that next to Colorado? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he used to go to the Boulder University and they would clean the toilets at night. Right? And that's how they got the money to support the temple. Right? So like that. The point is you do anything for Krishna. It means you're managing for Krishna. So you're doing a kshatriya activity, but you have to do it according to the qualities of that. Right? Same time as then they go out and do a shudra activity, they'd be cleaning it's a hired job. But they would do it properly in that way. They were pleased. Then they come back to the temple and, you know, do puja and things like that. And so one may have an area that he may be a central focus, but he can kind of like do anything for Krishna, because the mood's right. You know, when you come to the next level, then you must do according to your nature. You can do temporary or side things, or you can do things as sadhana, but that won't be regular.
Should those kind of people also be invited to join the temple? Those who, for example, if they want to join, but it's in some cases it's obvious that they will not be able to do that. And it seems to me that if we'll allow them to join, then that their moods will be like visible in the temple, and the temple will no longer represent like this cultural aspects.
Prabhupada mentioned that we should not expect, if we want to expand this mission to the whole world, we have to expect that not everyone is going to live in the temple. The whole idea is the mission is bigger than the temple. It may be defined that the legal entity, ISKCON, is the temple, right? And those who are living in the temple has to take care, is legally responsible, all these things. But ISKCON is the mission, right? Is bigger. That includes everybody who's living in the community and everything. So difficulty's been in the past that those in the temple will consider only if you're in the temple as the mission. So therefore, if you move out, then you kind of like give up, you know, properly situated, and you're thought of as not doing nicely. So in that case, then those even who temple life isn't the life that they are best suited for will try to stay there until they can't hold on anymore, and then just go out. And then when they go out, then they know everybody inside, and then they say, you know, why don't you be honest? And, you know, all this stuff. So it just goes back and forth. But the point is we have to be broad-minded. Someone asked a question yesterday, are we to be this point of being liberal or conservative? But we're both. You know, that's the point of the razor's edge. It's always in the middle. The what do you call that? Where you have these dichotomies would be the words. Dichotomies means you're off the razor's edge. The razor's edge is the perfect balance in the middle. So the dichotomy means that you're going out from there. Well, we're either liberal or we're conservative. But no, we're broad-minded and we follow the acharyas. You know? So broad-minded means we understand the principle. So we see anybody, whatever they're doing, then that's nice. You know, I think it's Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, that person who chants Hare Krishna is the best man in the crowd. So there's a crowd of people, you say, chant Hare Krishna, the one who does, they're the best person. Everybody else is just another face.
Mm-hmm. That it's easier to be either conservative or liberal than to be in the middle.
Yes, because conservative or liberal means I'm involved, my ego is involved. And my attachments are there. While being in the middle means not compromising. That's the thing. Then, when you have the dichotomy, then you compromise it to bring it to the middle. No. Our tradition is you resolve it, because they're both based on the same principle. Right? We're conservative means there's certain principles, and we follow the details, the traditional details with that principle. But we're broad-minded in that someone else is able to follow the principle, even though they don't follow the tradition. We accept that. Right? We may not do that, but it's accepted. You know, those early kirtans, Prabhupada encouraged everyone to come and bring anything to participate. They would bring all the strangest, weirdest instruments, and I think it was Hayagriva picked up an old broken piano, you know, that you couldn't play, but they would put it on the side of the temple because the strings were there. And now and again they would run something down the strings, you know. People have little bongos and all kinds of weird things and bells and, right, doesn't he even has bugle? Kelp horns. That's good. You know, like that. There's that one in San Francisco. Mukunda had a timpani. You know, like that. And you know, all these things are going on. Prabhupada would encourage it. That's broad-minded. But the principle is chant and glorify the Lord. So these people, if they bring something, they get more involved. They get more enthusiastic. Right? Because they identify with their thing. You know, this is me. You know, my kelp horn is, you know, it's my identity. So I engage my identity in Krishna service. But by doing that, you purify and you don't think you're the kelp horn anymore. So then now you can use some kartals or something, right? Right? But as long as you think you're the kelp horn, then you should play it for Krishna. You understand the principle? It means I think I'm the body and mind. So therefore, I think I'm an intellectual, I'm a manager, I'm a businessman, I'm this, I'm a brahmachari. So engage that in Krishna service. And when you don't think you're that anymore, then you can just perform the sadhana. And when you don't think at all I'm the body and all that, then I just serve Krishna in my original rasa.
So the principle for the temple should be to maintain the culture, and under that, in that direction, I choose the people who...
That's best. But this, as an educational institution, that means that anyone should be able to come, I mean, anyone who qualifies, you know, some basic qualification, should be able to come to the temple. I mean, anyone can come to the temple, take part in the programs. But to live in the temple, then should be those who actually will take advantage, either, you know, full-time or just they come part-time. You make facility that, you know, during summer vacations or other vacations, the students or other people can come on and get some experience. It's understood. You're here for 3 months, and then after 3 months, it's back to school. You know, unless we have understood that you are actually temple material and you really want to be in the temple. Otherwise, you should continue in your own line because you'll be happy. You know, you'll be satisfied. And then you won't find that sudden change from I've been in the temple for 10 years and I move out, and then the shock of, you know, hitting the material nature, you know. That you're already in the material nature, engaging it more and more, you learn more and more how to engage it, then it comes much more natural. So the temple should be very careful, as Prabhupada mentions, what is it? No lazies, no crazies in the temple. So it's I know one temple in India that works very, very well, and they take total care of their whole community, let alone the temple devotees. You know, they see that they are educated, they see that their medical things are taken care of, that they get married, they give counseling, they give personal spiritual counseling. Totally, they take care. But for the brahmacharis in the temple, when they assess them, they and the community assess, is this person fit to live in the temple? Like that. Then after assessing, when they're in the temple, then when they're asked to do a service and they say no, that's the day they pack their bags and go back home. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. It says, you move into this temple means if there's service you're supposed to do, you're asked to do it, you do it. And if you say no, and you don't have a reason, like they say, can you do this, Prabhu, and you have another service, okay. But if you don't have another service, you just don't want to do it, then why be in the temple? Because you won't inspire anybody. You're not going to give this good association to anybody. So the temple is too strict for you, too much for you. Move to a situation in which, when you want, you come to the temple, be fully engaged, and then go back. That'll be more honest. Right? That'll be more beneficial for the individual. And that temple, you know, it's like nobody has anything. They have a little cupboard that's out on the veranda, some, you know, out on the hallway. They sleep anywhere in the temple. You know, in the room, on the hallways, in the temple room. Get up in the morning, and whenever you see them, they're chanting, they're reading, they're studying. You never see any prajalpa, nothing. And if you go there, they're so nice, come, help, this, that. Because they only have people that belong in the temple in the temple. And then the community members in that temple, they respect the brahmacharis in that temple practically on the same level as the sannyasis. You know, there's a formal difference, but as far as relationship and ability to hear from them, they don't see any difference. They see the full dedication. Just some are more mature and some are less. But to them, it's the same tattva, like that. And it's a perfect example that it works. The community is happy and the temple is happy. Well, now you mix it. The community thinks wallahs in the temple aren't very together, and the wallahs in the temple think, you know, all the riffraff that lives outside. And you end up with nothing. There's no mission, you know. You just have a building that, you know, you have, you know, whatever it is, you have debts and other things like that. You know, it becomes a liability rather than an asset.
You were mentioning the different stages of devotion service. It's always understood how bhakti has to do with the heart, the purity of the heart, and, you know, in Krishna's philosophy and like that. So why is it called bhakti yoga?
Buddhi. Oh, why is it buddhi? Because buddhi means you use your intelligence. Means I'm doing it, that's what we started at. I'm doing it because I want to do it. I understand why I'm doing it. In the beginning I may come in and I just, you know, like the kirtan, like the halava, or, you know, it's like, you know, just very, you know, eccentric and esoteric and I'm attracted. But after a while you get to know, you learn. And then you can then you understand, I'm doing this, I'm chanting because of this reason, right? I'm rendering menial service because of this reason. I'm listening to authorities because of this reason, you know? I get up in the morning, I attend the classes because of this reason. I serve because of this reason. So the intelligence is there, like that. Another aspect, yeah, so that's the best use of intelligence is understanding Krishna is the Lord, we're His servant, and we engage in His service. So that's the best intelligence. So the devotees of the Lord are the most intelligent. Then another aspect is that because Krishna says the whole path is His path. We discussed this before. That whole path is His path. So anything on the path, if the purpose of doing it is to get to the goal of pure love, it's counted within the path of bhakti. Right? So therefore, buddhi yoga, or where we're using our intelligence, means our intelligence, we're doing it, because that's sadhana. Then we're doing it for Krishna. Therefore, it's counted as part of the path of bhakti. Right? You understand? So Krishna's accepting whatever we're offering, though it's not in pure love. Occasionally we have some good feeling, or we have always some feeling, but it's not so developed. But Krishna's taking whatever it is. Because the whole point of bhakti is that with love we serve Krishna and He reciprocates, so that rasa is there. But our rasa, our relationship may be very small. Krishna accepts whatever that is. So He's broad-minded. He's not liberal. He's broad-minded. Liberal means I give up the rules. Broad-minded means I understand how those rules apply in a broader sense. Like that. That's how Prabhupada could engage everyone because he was broad-minded. We're having trouble now because we're liberal, right? Like we're liberal in America. But how we're liberal only applies to America. You take that liberality to India, it just creates hell. It may be fabulous in India, But people spit on us. I mean, maybe fabulous in America, but people spit on us in India. You know? I know one devotee that his mother tried to have him taken out of the temple in so much pressure because he found out that one boy and girl actually arranged their own marriage. She just immediately said, these people are uncultured, Malecha Yavana rascals. And I don't want my son, who's from a good, upstanding, you know, family, you know, we can say what our lineage is back to the sons of Lord Brahma. You know, we've been vegetarian for that long. You know, it's not that we don't know who or what our lineage is, you know, what species of we are. And like that, I don't want my son involved in such a movement because, you know, they say they're Vedic, they're not Vedic. These are reactions, this is reality, reactions, and there's millions of people like that there. So liberal in the modern sense means it's American. That's basically what it means. You know? Liberality means that. It means that culture which went from barbarism to degradation without the interim of civilization. Right? That culture goes everywhere. So we have to be very, very careful. Because when we talk international, then that means there must be an identity. Right? And if we want to get into details, it means something everybody has to go with. So that means you have to pick the lowest common denominator. Someone on a lower level cannot come up to a higher level. And to work, someone on the higher level will have to come down. Therefore, broad-minded means we maintain the principles. We have international principles. And we will apply them, and as people surrender, we will bring them in and bring them up. So there's a difference. That's why liberality is a problem. Because liberality is dealing with the ritual, and taking that is the important thing. Well, broad-minded is taking the principle as the important, and the detail as adjustable to the time, place, and circumstance. So there's a major difference between liberality and broad-minded. Sometimes the acharyas will use the word liberal, but it means broad-minded. You know? Like that. In other words, they're interpreting the principle, not interpreting the detail or the ritual. Right? Does that make some sense? So you have to be very, very careful. Like that. Yes.
Along those same lines, a little bit of what you were saying, you know, sometimes in our society we attempt to introduce some aspect of Vedic culture, just as an example, say betrothing of girls at 12 or something. And because we don't have this supportive culture, it doesn't seem to work. So how can we understand what to adapt to?
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. No, that's a very important point. Basically, is we have to understand the principle. See, it always goes back to that. I mean, it's a very important principle, is that you have to understand what is going on there. That is the main thing. The ritual is a way of maintaining, like, I have a particular mood. So there's ways I like to do things. So if I don't have the mood, then I want to train somebody else. I have the mood, I do the activity. I want to train somebody else. The mood is the difficult thing to understand. I can teach them the activity. Then once they have the activity or adjusted with it, then I can start to point out the mood. Right? Like Arjuna, Krishna first talks about activity. Second chapter, he's just talking about, you know, you're a kshatriya, you don't do it, others will laugh at you, and humiliation is worse than death, and so many different things. He's just dealing on that level. Then he goes into all the activities, engaging the body, engaging the mind, how you must do all these things. All the activities, the karma yoga, the jnana yoga, the buddhi yoga, all these different aspects. Once that's all in place, then he gets down to, okay, now you understand activity. You understand the technique, the field of activity. Now understand the mood behind that. Now do all these things without attachment, thinking of me, without desiring result, and without thinking you're the doer. Right? And with the purpose of becoming his devotee. Manmana bhava mad bhakto mad yajiman namaskuru. And the whole idea is you're giving up all these attachment to religious activities because they are to be done. No, they are to be done because I said so. And you're doing them for me. Therefore, it goes back to the manmanabhava manpakto. Right? Because Krishna says, offer obeisances. Krishna says, worship. He gives a system of worship. So Krishna gives all that. So I do it for him. So anything that's a ritual that's not connected to him, I throw out. That's sarva-dharmam parityaja. I reject religious activities being done for the purpose of religion or material motive. Right? And that's the end. That's the final teaching. Right? After that, it closes the Gita. Then we open Bhagavatam. Right? Then we have the invocation, and then the next verse where it's actually giving direction says, all religious activities that are being done for material motive are kicked out. So we see this is where the Gita ends and the Bhagavatam starts, on this principle of religious activities being done for material motive is thrown out. I do religious activities for Krishna. Right? So when we go into these, if we want to introduce these, we shouldn't be going into them for material motive. We have to see what it is that's going on there. And take the whole picture, then you see there's not problem. Principle there, given that example, the whole idea is, I mean, many things are there, but in the Vedic culture, one has to understand, very broad field to understand these things. Is there's a vast difference between the boys and the girls in their growing up. Basically, the basic principles of what kind of mentality they have at what age will be there, you know? When they are more active, when they're more gentle, when all these different things, that's there. But you will find that the girls take material life seriously from the age of 12, like that. The boys don't start taking it serious till 18, 19, 20, like that. Means you put a boy and a girl together in their teens. The girl is thinking, this is some substance. We'll get married, have a house, children, all these things, making these plans. The boys just think, I'm having a good, great time. You know, it's nice to be with the girls. It's so nice. And, you know, I like it. That's all. They're not thinking any way of any seriousness or maturity in the relationship. It's just, it's nice. Like that. So, therefore, the Vedic culture says that there should be a 6 to 8 year difference between the boy and the girl. Because then you have the same platform of maturity. The girl started at 12 taking, you know, grihastha life seriously. And the boy at 18 or whatever it is, 20, 21, 22, he starts taking it seriously. So if you marry these two, then you have a serious match. Because then they'll have the same sophistication of material desires. Otherwise, you marry an 18-year-old girl to an 18-year-old boy, she's way ahead of him. He can't keep up with it, you know? He's just thinking, well, you know, I'll go out, look in the paper, get a job, like that. She's already thinking 4-bedroom house and 2 cars and all this kind of stuff, and it just doesn't match, you know? He can't keep up with it. So the whole idea is that that must be there, you know? I mean, so many aspects are there in that. Then you have the aspect of it should be a natural relationship of the wife as the dharma patni. Means that she's fixed in dharma, performing the religious activities. And the husband is the guru pati, or the leader in the spiritual direction. So if they're the same age, then we see by the maturity and all that, she is more together. So that won't come naturally. She'll have to guide him on how to run things. And it'll be very hard for him to then be guided on the material things, but to be the guide in the spiritual. So if you give this age difference, then you also get a very natural kind of thing where he feels, I can guide, because the wife is younger, especially when they marry at that age. He'll see her as a young girl. So then he knows her from that age, and then he deals with her. You know, you have like Prabhupada, he was 21 and his wife was 11. So he will deal with her as a young girl, means having the maturity and all that. And then as they grow up, then that relationship is established. He'll always be kind to her. So Maharaj's point is the women must always be protected. But that is supposed to be a natural thing. Because you just naturally protect someone who's in a position of vulnerability. So then you take care. So that age difference creates that. You know, another aspect of that is hmm. so many. This is a vast field. Somehow it's all just evaporating. You ever have that happen? So many things are there, and then it just starts to evaporate, and then you wonder what it is. I guess the Lord doesn't want you to talk about it or something. So then it's, you see these things with Swayambhuva Manu, his daughter. Now he's marrying his daughter to Kardama. He cares. And he shows that care by getting in the chariot with his wife and his daughter to go see what is the arrangement. He's going to hand his daughter over. Means he's taken care, given full shelter. Then when he sees the boy is qualified, he hands her over to his care. Then it's nice. Otherwise, if he's here and he's there, and okay, it's great, you go there. She's unsheltered in the middle. And it's kind of like the father didn't care that much. He only took it that far. He didn't bring it all the way to see that it actually was good. And so that mood is also there. So when we're talking about these engagements, that's there. So that means that the girl is still under the care of the family. So they will see that she's taken care of. They won't let the boy and girl associate, you know, and do anything weird. Because that means that the family or the community is not protecting their girls. Like that. Very, very important aspect. So when it's allowed like that, means there's no protection. And then when something goes wrong, those individuals are to blame. But actually, it's the communities to blame. You know? The whole point is, protect women means you have to have, means women have their character. You have to have men who have the character to be able to help them, to take care of them. So if you don't have that, and then the women feel, well, you got to take care of it yourself, because you got to be practical, right? Because they've been, like I said, they've been thinking about it since 12. So it's like, you got to get it together. And if no one else is going to do it, you do it yourself. So then that situation, then the men are weak for that to come up. It means they're not giving the thing. And then it's hard for the men to become strong. Just like you see, the child who lives in the house with the mother is not very strong in his own initiative, because the mother will take care. Well, when they go to the Gurukul and working under the teacher, they become strong. Then they're qualified to come back and work properly with the woman to maintain a relationship. Well, if they always stay with the women, then they don't become strong enough to actually take care. So they become strong outside of the house, while the women become strong in the house. So this principle, the men are always under, they'll never become strong enough, and the women will just become more and more frustrated. Because there's certain things that it's difficult for them to take care of. And it's expected the men will take care of it. And the men are such wimps, they can't take care of it. Women have to take care of themselves. It becomes very, very painful. So when you look at a point like this, you have to look at the whole community. Well, what is the community doing to take care of our members here? We have girls, we have boys growing up. What are we doing to see that they're properly trained and married? It's not an individual thing. You know, we may say, well, in India it's individual because there's a community already there. We have to establish community. That means all the members of the community are worried about that. Like this. Otherwise, why have the children if you're not going to take that all the way? You know, having children means, at least for the boys, seeing that they're trained nicely in devotional service so that they're able to go off into their own way and perform their activities. Then having a girl means bringing it to the point of marriage. That's a responsibility. And then after that, then one's responsibilities are over. Then vanaprastha is there. That's a natural thing. Now the next generation, it's their turn. You know? And I should leave it to them, give them their headspace, and don't get in their way. And I will move on to you know, more studying, more reading, and all these preaching, and helping train others who are new in this. Like that. I may still work in the grihastha field, but now, from a teaching point of view, like that. So, I mean, these are only part. We didn't really get down to the point of the age, you know. But what I'm saying is that if you want to understand that, you have to understand so many things behind it. Because it's the maximum rules are when you have the situation of grihastha ashram. You have very few rules for brahmachari vanaprastha sannyas. Right? And you don't need all the varnas just for them. Like that. So all the main body of rules is Grihastha Ashram. So it takes the greatest study to understand. So just to take it and, well, you know, we want to get rid of the daughters, so, you know, arrange something at 12 and then have it turn into a fiasco. That's not mature. One has to study the whole field. Then it makes sense. Then it becomes very nice, you know? So we'll end here. The time has come. I think we're 45 seconds over. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki. Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki. Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.